Battle for the Big Top is as rollicking, infectious, and enthralling as the subject it covers. With verve and style to spare, Les Standiford spins an unforgettable and addictively readable yarn about the three great showmen of the wildest of all entertainments, the American circus. What a blast. Dennis Lehane is right. What a blast it is. Les is my guest on this edition of The Literary Life, the director of the creative writing program at Florida International University. Les Standiford once again plumbs the richness of the Gilded Age, giving us a front row seat under the big top where the greatest show on earth is always on display. Les, thank you for being a guest on The Literary Life.
It's my pleasure.
So with this new book that you've written, Battle for the Big Top, which is all about the circus, and you know, we all love circuses, but with the demise of the circus, why is it that we should all still be thinking about P.T. Barnum, James Bailey, and John Ringling? What is their lasting legacy as circuses have kind of gone away?
Well, thank you for that question, Mitchell, because I think it's a good one. I started off with this project thinking it would be entertaining, largely. It would be fun to write about the bearded lady and the alligator man and the elephants and so on. And indeed it was. If people have half as much fun reading this book as I had in writing it, they'll get their money's worth. But as I worked and got deeper and deeper into the material, I came to understand that the circus was important, and understanding the importance, understanding the circus and why it was so popular for so long in the country is key to understanding who we are as a people. Over the past 100 years, entertainment platforms have shifted so rapidly, radio, then the movies, then television, then VHS, and then streaming and cell phones, we're at the point now where entertainment's being beamed right into your hands and while you're driving down the, not just into your living room, but into your bedroom, into your car, or into your bathroom, on your cell phone. And all that's taken place, those rapid and massive changes in how entertainment's delivered to us. For the better part of a century before that, there was only one popular entertainment platform in the country that amounted to anything, and that was the circus. It went to where the people were, 7,000 to 10,000 people in an afternoon or an evening performance would gather together to watch that. And this is a day long before professional baseball franchises. There were theaters that might hold 200 or 300, 400 people, but there was nothing else like the circus where masses of people came together to be entertained.
So paint a picture for us of what a 19th century circus goer would find, when the circus came to town. What was it that they were looking for? And what was the antecedent to that?
Well, the circus in its heyday, as typified by Barnum and Bailey, The Greatest Show on Earth, was a mightily more sophisticated entity than the first circuses that mud shows, they were often called, that traveled across the frontier in the wake of the advance of settlers. They traveled in horse-drawn wagons on roads that were unpaved. Reason they were called mud shows is that those roads would turn to quagmires after the first rain, and getting from one venue to the next overnight, mind you, the circus would only play a given town one night, and then it was on to the next place, 30 or 40 miles away across Terra Incognita. And these, despite the fact that transportation was rudimentary, the nature of the entertainment that went on under the tents that these mud shows carried was fascinating. Hamlin Garland, the 19th century novelist, writes in a book called Boy Life on the Prairie of going to the shows after going to the circus that had come to his small town, Indiana, after a long week of work in the fields, planting or harvesting crops or milking the dairy cows, and spoke of it as if he'd, as those acts poured into the tent and performed before these people who didn't see anything of pleasure. But once a year would come the circus with these unbelievable costumes, with these never before seen exotic animals, lions and tigers and elephants and giraffes, and beautiful ladies dressed up in sequined outfits performing these unbelievable acrobatics up in the air, walking tight ropes and jumping from bar to bar, hand to hand. Well, this was just fascinating. This is beyond the pale. This was, in fact, the impossible being made true before your very eyes. And what I came to understand about the importance of the circus that we were talking about earlier was that, you know, America was a country founded on the notion that anything was possible here. Your previous bounds in the country where you'd lived before were unfettered. And once you came to the United States, if you worked hard enough and long enough and you cared enough, you could transform yourself. Anything was possible. Sky's the limit. The frontier lay beckoning in front of you. And in fact, when you went and spent 3 hours at the circus watching literally people do things that were thought to be impossible physically, it was a metaphorical reminder that that's why people had come to this country in the first place and why they're still knocking the doors down trying to get in here. Because of all the countries on earth, this is the place where anything can happen for anyone. And that's what the circus said to you. And it also gave rise to that mythic notion that if you weren't satisfied with your lot in life in Cambridge, Ohio, or that's where I grew up, or some other small town, if you weren't satisfied with the way things were going, what you could do is run away and join the circus.
Right. And as you know, literature is filled with stories in which people did that, right? Where they
absolutely
went on the road, followed a circus, followed their dreams. So tell me though, what changed? Was it these three guys and their vision that made the circus, that took it from the mud show to the big top? What was it
part of
that changed?
Part of the mission in the circus was always to put on the biggest and the best show. And once P.T. Barnum got involved, which he had not been involved in the circus before he was 60 years old, mind you, he'd spent most of his life as what you might call a presenter of human oddities, Tom Thumb and the Fiji Mermaid. And he had a kind of Ripley's Believe It or Not Emporium, where amazing things were put on, you know, weird stuff was put on display down in Lower Manhattan. You get a lot of that in the Showman movie. He hadn't had anything to do with the circus until 1871. And once he teamed up with Bailey, who came to him, and two of them got together, and Barnum said, "I'll take this out, this whole undertaking, to another level in terms of size, in terms of array of acts." The circus went from one ring entertainment below the tent to two, and then to three, so that if you're sitting there, you can barely hold your attention, on everything that's going on in front of you. Well, that was on purpose in Barnum's mind. He wanted sensory overload. He wanted to outdo, make a spectacle that had never been seen before in anywhere, and he succeeded. And if he weren't enough, then along come the Ringling Brothers, these upstarts in Wisconsin who went to a circus once and were so impressed, they said, well, we've got to do that ourselves. And by George, don't you know that it took them 25 years to create it, but they did. And they became the chief competitor for Barnum and Bailey and eventually outdid them, bought up after Barnum and then Bailey's death, Barnum was calling the greatest show on earth, and you had the combined shows, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, greatest show on earth. And from 1907 to 1930, that was the pinnacle of circusdom in the whole world.
During that period, how cutthroat, before they merged, was the competition?
The competition and some of the shady things that happened were mostly confined to the smaller shows, because Barnum and Bailey and Ringling, once you got to that level, they were earnest in competing with one another, but the shady tricks had kind of fallen by the wayside. For one thing, Bailey was a stickler about upstanding business practices, and so was John Ringling. They thought they could outdo each other simply by bringing in bigger and better acts. But before they came along, it would be nothing for one smaller show to come into town, post its bills, and then the next night have a competing show come in, tear down their billboards and their posters and slap up their others. Or a competing show would come in and bribe a local newspaper to run unflattering editorials about how chintzy the competing show was, and how you were going to be fleeced out of your money, and don't go to their show, go to the other show. And this sort of thing went on in the smaller shows all the time. Crooks would strike deals with unscrupulous members of a troupe, and they might pay off a local sheriff to look the other way while they burgled homes while people were under the big top watching the show. Or and a lot of laundry used to go missing from clotheslines while people were diverted watching the circus, and on and on and on. Lots of stories like that. By the in the biggest of the big time, it was more about who can do this better than the other guy.
P.T. Barnum also said, when entertaining the public, it's best to have an elephant. So talk about the importance of the elephant in the circus.
Well, you know, circuses became popular on the continent and in the United States before, and circus acts became popular before zoos were widespread. And so given that animals were used in acts, horses and dogs and zebras and giraffes and elephants eventually, it'd be a part of an adjunct to the circus coming to town was the circus parade, where people got to see these creatures being paraded down Main Street. And then they'd also set up a menagerie tent where, for an afternoon and an evening, when the elephants or the zebras or whatever it was were not performing, kids could go by with their popcorn and just gawk at these creatures and, you know, for 10 cents, throw the seal of fish and, you know, watch something that had never been seen before, usually, because there weren't zoos, because there wasn't TV, wildlife television with Jack Hanna showing you every creature known to mankind on a weekly basis. You know, that just didn't exist.
And you talk about how the golden age was up until about 1930, when there was this incredible growth and the circus was thriving. We all know what happened in 1930 with the coming of the Depression. Is that what put a crimp in the circuses at that point? Is that what started
the decline? Well, by that time you also had radio had become popular. You had movies had become an actual event that people went to in theaters, as opposed to, you know, short reels they might see in an arcade. They'd become actual dramatic spectacles that siphoned off audience. But the Great Depression itself, the economic downturn, really didn't do in the circus. People were still willing to pay that 50 cents or a dollar admission to go see what. In 1929, for instance, John Ringling netted his net profit was the equivalent of $100 million in today's money. So it was still going strong. Some theorize that what really and truly did the circus in was the automobile. By 1930, we had a depression, but we also had 85% of families in the United States had access to an automobile. And what this meant was that they could go for what they considered, whatever entertainment they sought, they could hop in the car and go to it. Prior to the circus had always come to the people. Circus had followed the population on these muddy roads at first, and then on the railroads that expanded America so rapidly, and then on highways. But as more and more people themselves became mobile, they could pick and choose where they wanted to go and what they wanted to see. And that led to a splintering of entertainment possibilities that really marked the beginning of the end for the circus. And principally because it just cost too much money to take this thing on the road. It was such a complicated show. You had to feed, you had a 1,000 people working on the show, whom you had to feed, you had to school the children, you had to move them from place to place on a nightly basis. So you were running a transportation company too, a restaurant business and an entertainment business, and spending salaries also had skyrocketed from the 20s to the to after the World War II, where wages were 10 to 20 times what they had been in the 20s. And given that you had such a labor-intensive show, that also put the death knell to the complicated, moving that complicated circus and keeping it going.
But then it took another 70 or 80 years until the very last circus that you happened to go to, the last performance. And you opened your book so movingly about that in the introduction. So it was a long decline. I remember going to the circus as a kid in Miami, on Miami Beach. Circus would come to town and there'd be a big march of the elephants and the whole entire circus, you know, from the train station over the causeway, over the Biscayne Bay into Miami Beach. And I was mesmerized by it for years and years and years. I wasn't aware that it was in the middle of the decline, but yeah, it still brought a lot of thrills to so many of us. So it did take a while, and maybe because of the strength of what it presented, people didn't want to let it die, right?
It did. It maintained that appeal. The Feld family, who bought it from the Ringling heirs in the mid-1960s, loved it. They were under the spell of the circus themselves. And that on that last night that you mentioned, Kenneth Feld came out with his whole family and the children and grandchildren. There were about 70 of them gathered in the ring. It looked like a small high school graduating class out there. And he talked in a very moving way about the labor of love that the Feld family had undertaken for the past 50 years. And he said that it had always been touch and go, but they'd been able to keep it limping along for all that time until 2015, when owing to the mounting pressure from animal activists, they finally let the elephants go out to pasture. And he said that marked the end. Attendance, spotty as it had been at that point, fell directly off a cliff. Without elephants, there just wasn't any audience. And, you know, 100 years before, 125 years before P.T. Barnum had uttered those words, when entertaining the American public, it is necessary to have an elephant. And his words were clearly prophetic.
Les, tell me, the biggest catastrophe that occurred during the circus, and you describe it so well in the book, and B, give me two or three of the most popular acts over the lifetime of either the Ringling Brothers or the Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Well, I opened book with a recounting of the terrible Hartford Circus fire of 1944. And fire had always been the bane of the circus because of the straw and the flammable tents that they used. And in the early days, illumination was by candle or kerosene lamp. And there were always terrible problems with fires around circuses. But the worst of, no tent had ever caught fire. No one had ever died. No customer had ever died during a circus performance of the Ringling Brothers Circus until 1944, when at the Hartford event, the tent caught fire and more than 500 people died in the calamity. And that could have ended the circus. It's one of the reasons why I brought it up. It could have ended the circus right there. And in fact, city fathers of Hartford immediately impounded the show, what was left of it, and said, we're going to sell off everything you've got in order to pay the claims that are sure to come rolling in. And John Ringling North, the nephew of Ringling, stepped in and said, look, if you take everything we've got and sell it, that'll be the end. You'll get pennies on the dollar, and that'll be the end of it. And the people who need to be compensated won't see anything. Let us go back out on the road. We will earn our keep, and we will pay these claims. And so the city fathers let that happen. And over the next 3 years, the circus prospered. And in fact, every single claim that was presented to the on behalf of the victims of that fire were paid off. The accident itself continues to be commemorated on a yearly basis in Hartford, really living history up there. And I use it as an example of, well, what might have killed the circus then and there, it still went on 75 years after that, because I think of what you point out, there's the unquenchable characteristics, the pleasures that people saw there, despite changing tastes and all the other pressures and all the competition. Now, as to the some of the great acts of circusdom, I think everybody remembers the Wallendas. Wallendas still perform. They travel. They do exhibitions. They walk across canyons. Carl Wallenda in the 1970s walked a tightrope across a mile wide gorge in North Carolina, for heaven's sakes. He died while he was walking from church steeple to church steeple in Puerto Rico, doing the same thing. I think everybody remembers the Wallendas for their daring and also for some of their tragic accidents. And the greatest clown, the famous most famous clown, there's probably a portrait of Weary Willie on 20% of the homes in the United States. Somebody's got a copy of that picture of that hobo that Emmett Kelly immortalized as a member of the Ringling Circus in the 40s and the 50s. Clyde Beatty was the fabled lion tamer. His was kind of a macho act, which he said was all show. He said if one of those tigers that he worked with really wanted him, what good was a whip and a chair going to do him? He'd be dead in 10 seconds. That was all cooked up to make it look more dangerous than it was.
You know, Les, we know you as, I know you, and a lot of people know you as the the director of the creative writing program at Florida International University. You started your career as a fiction writer. You worked in film. And then you moved into nonfiction. You moved into that whole world of creative nonfiction, of narrative nonfiction. And I think the beauty of Battle for the Big Top is that you have taken all that was successful in your career as a fiction writer and you've brought it to the world of nonfiction. Can you talk a little bit about why you made that transition or what made you think of making that transition?
Well, the appeal of it for me is much like the appeal in the circus. It's a little complicated to explain. You have to remember that unlike movies and streaming, computer-based art, every amazing thing that happens in the circus is real. It's not a magic show. There's no illusion there. When an elephant dances the ballet in the circus, it's an elephant dancing the ballet. It's not Disney with a bunch of animators creating that effect. It really happens. When people do those death-defying leaps and those walks across the tight wires, they're really doing that. When an automobile does a loop-the-loop, a backflip in the circus, it's a real car doing it, not some kid playing a video game thinking he can defeat invaders with a death ray, that's the difference. In fiction, you see, you can make up a plot, just like somebody who, as long as it's reasonably credible and entertaining, like somebody who concocts some sort of video game where a Rambo-like character can wail away and defeat any number of assailants, in nonfiction, I'm tasked, or I tasked myself with telling a story that was as compelling as a novel without making anything up by using the stuff of reality. And, somebody else is going to have to be the judge of whether or not I'm successful at it. But to me, that becomes the real challenge and the fun that I get out of writing nonfiction, to try to make it as captivating as a story that I'd made up, only everything's real. And the hard part of that, of course, is to go out and do the research and find the material that you need to put that story together.
You know, Stuart Onan says of this book that Les Standiford understands that to know the American soul, one needs to understand the circus. And Eric Larson writes of this book that that these guys that you write about, Les, managed to bring Gilded Age America its most compelling source of entertainment, being the circus. I want to put those two things together. You've written three books now about the Gilded Age, pretty much. It was Last Train to Paradise, which talked about Henry Flagler. Meet You in Hell, which was about Carnegie and Frick. And now you've written this book, Battle for the Big Top, Barnum, Bailey, and Ringling. So what is it about the Gilded Age that tells us something about the American soul?
Well, the Gilded Age has connotations of grandeur, but to Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain, who's generally credited with coming up with the concept of the Gilded Age, he did not see that as a flattering commentary. Gilded to him was something that had the appearance of the surface look of gold, but underneath might be base metal. And what he was decrying there was the money-grubbing aspect of the Gilded Age, where in its ultimate stages, he worried that people were concerned not with what was being done, but with the material gains that were being made and all the excesses of the nouveau riche and so forth and so on. And of course, he had a point. He was Mark Twain, after all. But On the other hand, this was also the period when the United States outdistanced itself from every other manufacturing nation in the world. You know, just about everything you can think of, the television, from radio to telegraph to the railroad to steel, you name it. All these enterprises took shape during the Gilded Age. And of course, they produced a lot of wealth. And of course, they produced a lot of excess. But I think my fascination and a lot of folks who look back ask are interested in the Gilded Age because they wonder, what was it? You know, what coalition of forces conspired to make all that happened during that period in the United States, and what can we learn from that? People still hark back to that and say, "Oh my heaven's sakes! Remember those days when those things happened, and men like Carnegie came along, and Rockefeller, and Flagler, and Barnum and Bailey." To come back to them for a moment. They weren't making money. They were astounding people. They were giving people something that they'd never seen before. They were motivated to do things in the entertainment world that had never been done before, to raise amazement to untold heights because they thought it was just good, a good thing.
Beautifully said, Les. Les, this has been amazing. Thank you for being a guest on the Literary Life. I would love it if you could maybe read a little something that you might have that would give us a flavor of the book, Battle for the Big Top.
Let's see if I can come up with, here's a little story about Ringling. In his later years, when he was living in retirement at Cotazan, this magnificent home, a little bit of Sunset Boulevard overtones here because he wasn't making any money. At this point, he was on hard times, but his character had not diminished. And this Richard North says of his uncle, he spent the remainder of his days at Cotazan, where North came following his graduation from Yale to serve his beloved uncle as, in his words, business agent, chauffeur, handyman, and sometimes cook. And while the image of an ambitious young man shut up in a great empty fading mansion with an elderly invalid who was facing ruin might conjure grim images straight from Sunset Boulevard, North insists that such was not the case. Through all, Ringling retained the uncanny ability to shut away thoughts of monetary peril and deteriorating health and comported himself, as North puts it, quote, as though the sap of youth were boiling through his veins and the money were rolling in. One evening during dinner, North went to answer a pounding at the mansion's front door, where he found a U.S. Marshal demanding to see Mr. Ringling. North was experienced enough by this point to realize that here was another court summons about to be served. "I'm afraid he's not in," North told the Marshal. At about the same time came Ringling's voice echoing down the hallway, demanding that the nurse bring more wine to the table. "Well, I'm afraid he is," said the Marshal. "You tell him I'm not going anywhere." When North returned to the table to advise Ringling of the situation, Ringling waved a hand. "Very well, tell him to wait." With North back in his seat, Ringling continued a story he'd begun before the interruption, following it up with several more, all the way through dessert, coffee, and leisurely digestives. When the ceremony of dinner had finally come to an end, Ringling gave a nod toward the great entry hall. "If you give me a hand, we'll go see about this fellow," he said. They found the Marshal in the vast hall with hat in hand, looking a bit daunted by the splendor surrounding him, any lingering taste of his bluster flittering away when Ringling greeted him as expansively as a duke welcoming his local magistrate, full of apology for having kept the man waiting. Following another story or two and a pointing out of this artifact and that in the grand room, Ringling ultimately accepted the papers from the Marshal, who by that time seemed almost apologetic for his errand. Ringling ushered the man out into the night with a hearty farewell, closed the door behind him, and turned to tuck the papers away in his coat with a wink at his nephew. Whatever was written on those papers, North understood, the eyes of John Ringling were unlikely ever to fall upon it.
Oh, my guest on The Literary Life is Les Standiford, and the book is Battle for the Big Top, P.T. Barnum, James Bailey, John Ringling, and the death-defying saga of the American circus. Les, thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you for having me. I love to talk about the circus.